I am so much trouble.
Wow.
I'll fix that. I'll fix that in editing.
Yeah, that's what we always say. How you doing, Michael? You just got back from Houston.
Yes, I was down at the Grace Hopper Festival conference for the last couple of days. My team was down there. I have 45 women engineers that were down there. We did a bunch of stuff. It was the first time I was down there, so it was great. Houston, not great. Grace Hopper, awesome.
Yeah, you're going to get me in trouble, but I did a stint in Houston a few years ago, and I chose not to take the job after. Grace Hopper seemed pretty cool, though. How was it? Was like 12,000 people there?
12,000 folks. I took a picture of this crowd at one point and sent it to my daughter, and she's like, "Why are you sending me pictures of crowds?" I'm like, "Look closely." And it was this massive room full of women engineers. It's just not something you see a lot of. So it was really cool.
And I feel like it kind of didn't get as much attention as it could have. It was effectively three times the size of WWDC.
Right. And they added 4,000 attendees from this time to the prior time. So I don't know. I felt like it got a ton of attention, but I was there and I was just sort of, I was in the swirl. So maybe if you weren't there, you probably have a different perspective, but it was all I did for like 2 weeks.
Yeah. Outside of the little sphere. And I realize how stupid that is to be, have you on the show and then immediately start talking. we'll address that at some other point. Anyway, so that's what you've been doing recently, and that's great. So we have 45 women engineers out of an organization of how many?
So it was, I think it's 53 total. I'm 298 engineers. So what is that? Like I'm about 20, somewhere in mid-20s or so, which given sort of how it plays out in this world right now is actually pretty good. But it's something that we're working a lot on, the whole diversity angle, not just obviously women, but underrepresented minorities. We set a set of goals for ourselves by 2017, which is just a very small thing to start doing, but it's something that we're worrying a lot about.
Yeah. I mean, it's if you have a metric that you can measure yourself against, I think that's a good thing. Yeah. And just to reiterate, you're not just at Pinterest, you're the director of.
I am the head of engineering.
Head of engineering.
Titles seem to be having a backlash on them. Have you noticed? It's no longer like cool to be a VP or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like, we will have no titles. I want to be flat. But you need to have something that sort of indicate like, hey, I'm the guy or the girl in charge of the whole damn thing. So head of engineering is the current title.
Okay.
Or whatever it is.
Cool. Yeah. I just wanted to let people know that we're not just talking to some random
Schmo.
Yeah. You actually have some kind of sway in this kind of thing. But let's just do a little background first, because you've had a pretty storied career, or unstoried is the way I'd like to put it, really, because you were kind of dark. You know what I mean? Like,
what do you mean, guy? Where are you going with this?
In that I don't think for like a lot of the jobs that you've had, you'd like to advertise them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And yet you've been, you know, reasonably public person.
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to when I sort of engaged in the larger community, which is around the time that I was Apple. I worked there for about 8.5 years. And I, for reasons that should be obvious, I was writing a lot, but I was using a pseudonym, Rands. And mostly because it wasn't popular to be having a public persona while you worked at Apple. So there was always that risk of saying something or getting yourself in some sort of awkward situation where you were at odds with what Apple leadership was looking at. So I just started there and the name stuck, which is why I have this, you know, go to conference name, which is Rands, which is my wife's maiden name. But that, yeah, it was kind of quiet. So it's odd. I have this sort of dual personality problem where, you know, I'm walking around and people say, Rands. I'm like, and I know exactly who they're talking about, but it's not me. It's this other person.
So you get to duck.
Right. So I'm like, oh, yeah, Rands, he's cool. but then I'm also this guy named Michael Lopp, who works at Pinterest. The two are sort of merging more. It's sort of getting more blurrier now that, you know, pseudonyms and that whole like culture of like having a different name is gone, but it's still out there and it's still sort of interesting because I know now when someone says Rams, I know it's like, oh, they're talking to that version of who I am.
Okay. So how did you get into technology? Like the comic I knew about, all of that kind of like your history, I'm pretty familiar with, but I don't know what kind of set the spark to the flame sort of thing.
My father was an engineer. He's a semiconductor physicist at HP. So there was a lot of technology in the house. And what he did was he made sure that whenever, as technology, this is like the 80s, as technology was showing up, that knew that I was always had something to do. So like there was an Apple II. And then when I got bored of that, he's like, and he'd get me a modem. So there was sort of getting me on the crack, if you will. Mm-hmm. And at some point it was just something that I did. And this was all, again, you know, these are the WordStar, Ami Pro, you know, days of technology, early PCs, you know, XT, AT, all those things. So started there. And then while I was in college, I got a gig at Borland as a QA engineer, part-time. And Borland turned into a full-time gig eventually as an engineer. And then Borland, Netscape, startup you've never heard of, Apple, Palantir, and then Pinterest.
So what were you doing at Borland?
I started as a QA engineer. I worked on a product called Paradox for Windows.
Yeah.
Right.
That's great. You're right. Paradox was an old spreadsheet for database. Yeah. Competed with DBase, right?
DBase. That's right. Wow. Wait, a nice pull. Yeah. So did that. Got in a big fight with Microsoft over the Office Wars at that time. We got the shit kicked out of us. And then, went to Netscape shortly after that, after a brief stint at Symantec.
I didn't know you were at Netscape ever.
I was early on at Netscape. I did 4 years there as part of the Navigator and then the Communicator team.
Man, we can't get rid of Netscape people.
I know. Don Melton, Eric.
Do you know Melton?
I work with Gramps. Yeah, I worked with them both at Netscape and also at Apple as well.
Yeah, at Apple, I was pretty sure you did, but not good. Anyway, here I was thinking we were forging new ground, but now stuck with the Netscape assholes. How was Netscape for you? Because that was a bit tumultuous, right? Because you were there for 4 years, and how long did it last? It's a viable thing.
Yeah, I came in just after the IPO, and it was all really kind of rosy. And I talked about this. You've probably heard me, guy, do this in a talk before. I remember the mail that came from a guy who now works at Instagram. His name is Jim Everingham. I think he was up at a Microsoft conference when they announced IE3. Right. And you remember him? I don't know. I'm dating myself here, but remember, like, Microsoft was just screwing up browsers for, like, version 1 and version 2. It was just awful. And it was, like, legit awful. And the mail came back, and I'm paraphrasing here from Jim. He's like, hey, just so you know, IE3 is coming. It does everything we do. It does it better. And they're introducing X, Y, and Z. And he's like, I'm not exaggerating. This is, like, we are going to get the shit kicked out of us if we And remember, this was Bill Gates just like went on a boat for like 2 weeks, read about a bunch of books and pivoted Microsoft in like months. Yeah. And this was one of the first things that came out of it.
Yeah. His email is a must read, basically. Yeah. Like the one that resets Microsoft is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was kind of, after seeing that happen at Borland, I'd actually gone through the Borland version of that where they were, you know, being
sorry, I'm not laughing.
It was funny, but it's my misery is hilarious, I think. but no, it was I saw it happen before. I'm like, I know how they're gonna do this. They're gonna come in big, they're gonna underprice, they're gonna just, you know, bundle everything together, all the things that they got in trouble for with the US government. Yeah. And it was the beginning of that downturn. That moment was there, and I guess a couple years later, you know, we did the layoff, and then we also, started Mozilla and that whole thing. Some good things came out of that, but it was not a great tail end of that.
Yeah. No, I don't mean to say that nothing good came out of that. It's just, it's rough times, you know. Especially putting it together. Mm-hmm. Boland also got Microsofted.
Yep.
Yes, it did.
Back when they used to just smash everything that they could. So.
Well, that was the thing. When I got to Apple and I was waiting for Longhorn to show up, I'm like, here it comes again. Everyone, brace yourselves. And
yeah,
Longhorn,
how did that feel?
It was crazy.
Because at Apple, can we talk about what you did?
Yeah, I was on the Mac OS X server team there. Yeah. And so I did that, and then I ran the Apple Store. So,
on the server team with Longhorn coming down the pipeline, that sucks.
Yeah, but they didn't. I got there. What was it? Jaguar, and then it was Panther, and then it was Tiger, I believe.
Yeah.
And each time, I remember we even did like campaigns at WWDC where we were like. You're like, start your copiers, because we were all waiting for it to like come out the subsequent year, and it never did. It was like, what was it, 7 years? I don't remember, but
God, it took forever. Yeah.
I was just giggling because Microsoft's ability to execute and get something out the door just vanished for some reason. And suddenly, you know, that was one of the reasons, Apple started to get so much ahead in a couple of different different industries, because they were just moving fast.
That would be interesting to know, actually, why Microsoft just fell apart.
I don't know. I guess that was when Bill left. I think he was – I think you had your sort of spiritual leader.
Yeah.
But it's – yeah, I don't – it also, you know, I've never worked there. I've talked with some folks. It got super political internally. You know, there was the cash cow in office. But it was just – it seemed like they just lost a driving force that just allowed it to kind of like eat itself.
Yeah. Have you ever read Mini Microsoft?
It's like an
insider's blog kind of thing. Years ago, around that kind of time period, he was just going, or it's synonymous, so maybe it's a woman, but going bananas about stack ranking and the way internal politics and was destroying Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And the name came from, I think he wanted to just, they wanted to just totally downsize it.
Yeah, no, it was... Yeah, it's to me, outsider looking in, being an engineer, it just lost its soul, right? That's something, it just became I make fun of MBAs, even though I have some really good MBA friends, but you let the spreadsheet folks take over and you get really good at spreadsheets. And that's what it felt like to me, was like there was that sort of engineering technical conscience that sort of vanished and it wasn't really driving it anymore. I see it in Xbox. I think Xbox is like the thing at Microsoft that feels like, you know, innovative and sort of looking ahead. But that's the only thing.
Yeah, I agree. Although they've taken a bath on their hardware sometimes.
Exactly.
Which is a shame.
Because the MBAs aren't in charge.
We're going to take a quick break so I can tell you about Udacity. Udacity is an outcome-oriented and project-based online education provider committed to the belief that the ultimate value proposition of education is a fulfilling life made possible by rewarding employment. You can enroll in and complete a nano-degree program, and you will experience best-in-class courses taught by expert instructors, benefit from close mentoring, rigorous project review, and supportive career guidance. Be certified with credentials built and recognized by industry leaders like Google, AT&T, Salesforce, Facebook, Cloudera, and more. Sign up for individual free courses and you'll experience best-in-class courses taught by industry experts, the same as the nanodegree program students. Craft your own independent study path. Learn the skills necessary to achieve your individual goals. And they're announcing new courses, beginning iOS app development. Start your journey in iOS app development. Do you want to build apps for iPhone and iPad? Great. Never written a line of code? No problem. If you're an individual with no programming experiences, but you're interested in developing apps for iPhone and iPad, this program provides you with a basic understanding and skills to get you started. You'll learn basic programming skills and specifically how to program in Swift 2.0, Apple's custom programming language designed specifically for building iOS and OS X apps. Once you've completed the program, you'll have a strong foundation in solving key problems with code, plus you'll be fully prepared to succeed in the iOS Developer Nano Degree, which is the ultimate stepping stone to a career in iOS development. Learn how to program program in Swift 2.0, Apple's custom programming language designed specifically for building iOS and OS X apps. Be challenged to solve problems in code that iOS developers face every day. Make three iOS apps functional with your own code. Work in Xcode the whole time, the development environment used to develop iOS and OS X apps. For more information, please go to udacity.com. That's UDACITY.com. Thanks, Udacity.
So following you, so you were at Apple for 8 years, you said?
8.5 years.
That's quite long.
Yeah, it is. It violates my rule of change a gig every 3 years. So I was there for, but it kind of doesn't because I was on the Mac OS X team. And then we did, I was getting bored and we're like, hey, let's do calendars and wikis and that sort of thing, which was fascinating. We totally screwed that up. So then I went over to, that was me, that was on me.
It was a cool idea.
It was a great idea.
I don't know if you screwed it up or if it just didn't get any traction. It's a different thing, right?
It's a, yeah, yeah.
For people who don't know, OS X server shipped with a wiki at some point, right?
Yes, yes, it did.
Oh, well. So that's a footnote in history.
Moving along. But then I worked on the store for a good long while, which was an amazing, amazing experience.
How was that? Because it seems like old technology meets. Like, is that a technology perspective in some ways, or is that like a retail?
What do you mean?
The store is unique in that it touches consumers.
Yes.
And you sell Apple's products. Like, that is a very rare place to be inside.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. It is, you're right, it's a blend. There is a very much, this is the face of the products to the users, but in a way that is less of the marketing angle. There's a much more detailed kind of nerd aspect to it. There was these, I forget what they were called, but you know the pages where, you know, you have all the different models on there. It's the table of attributes or whatever, and you can compare them.
Yeah.
Like, okay, hey, the MacBook Pro has this much, and this version has this much. It was like, that was one of the most traffic pages because people are looking for information. And like, you go to the other side and it's sort of like, wow, God, Force Touch. I want that because it's awesome. So it was, there was a different perspective there. You were really trying to be both sort of the face of the products, but also really informative in a way that the rest of the site was less so. It was very informative, but it was more the marketing piece. So, and then of course, all of the technology around the commerce side, and, you know, commerce is so, it was back then was so hard. You didn't have the Stripes. You didn't have all these folks that were basically going to go be world-class at credit card processing and all of the endless Byzantine bank regulations and all that stuff. That's just incredibly hard because you're between two businesses. So that was hard, hard, hard engineering problems. And just you're dealing with some of the worst outside of Apple. You're dealing with some of the lamest technology folks on the planet because they're not great at technology. So it was that was tricky as well. So commerce has gotten a lot better in the last 5 years thanks to folks really choosing to be great at it and say, like, whether it's a Stripe or these sorts of folks, it's just gotten a lot easier. So it would be a different story right now, but back then it was, whew, commerce hard.
Well, even the redesigned, reintegrated Apple Store
is
really nice. And he did it in almost like a light switch on way, which was incredible.
Yeah. No, I thought that was gorgeous. I think they've done some amazing work on the store. I really like the integration of the two faces, if you think of it like that.
So after Apple, you went to a black site.
I did not. I went to Palantir. I had this person ask me.
I don't even know
me,
if you want to talk about it.
I do.
We'll gloss over it a bit. But
no,
it's pertinent to the story, I think.
You know, people have opinions and sometimes they consider that. I saw Inside Out yesterday. It was brilliant, by the way.
Yeah. It's
and there was this one scene, it's a throwaway scene where joy and sadness get on the thought train and they knock over this box of facts and opinions, and I forget what the line was, but they said, "Hey, oh, here's all the facts got mixed with opinions." It's okay; it happens all the time. And if people have an opinion, I had someone ask me this at Grace Hopper, and they're like, "Hey, so did you do anything that wasn't evil at Palantir?" And it was just like, It was, you know, I mean, that's, it's an opinion, and I respect opinions, but there's so little fact there. So it's a Palantir, for those who don't know, it's a great company in Palo Alto. They're really working on some really interesting hard problems that the governments and big business have, especially around data and the ability to sort of pull in data, compare that data, and use all these different data sources to actually find insight. So in the wrong hands, that could be a very evil thing, but it's a very principled, it's a very talented group of engineers, and it's also with a CEO who is a very intelligent, smart, principled person. So it does end up that the company works with part of the government, but in a way that I think is highly principled. So anyway, go ahead. What are your questions?
Well, it's funny because my previous gig to this was at a company that did advanced analytics, right, and the clients were the NSA and the DEA, and we always joked that the worst one would be IRS. Because if they could start doing reverse lookups on what did you not pay, he sort of made you nervous.
Yeah, just for the record, we tease you, but yes, you do. That's okay. It's like, it doesn't mean anything more than that. I honestly, I'm fascinated by the idea of exploring data in ways that are not obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's something. I was not working as much in engineering as I was inside of Pinterest, so I have a bit much stronger opinion from the last year or so. Mm-hmm. But there's this world, again, be a good human, be principled, be nice about what you do, don't exploit people, all of that there. But there's a world where you look at this. We have an entire data science team at Pinterest, and their job is to find insight from the 66 petabytes of data that we have. And the goal is really simple, which is teach us how you're using the product so that we can make it better for you. And that's noble. I mean, that's value added, if you will. And it's incredibly, incredibly tricky task, given how much data it is, how much is showing up, and how much you got to sift through it and use a rigorous sort of mental approach for figuring out, you know, what is your question, what's your experiment, and how are you going to answer it?
I like the way that I like that you used experiment.
Yes.
Like you take a rigorous approach to this kind of thing.
We have actually, there's about, I don't know, somewhere between 100 and 200 experiments running on Pinterest at any given time. And to get a Pinterest experiment launched, which you might be a part of an experiment group if you've used Pinterest. And I know you both do because you love Pinterest.
I do, actually.
Me too.
But it's, you have to go through an entire rigorous process of like, okay, what's your thesis? What are you trying to prove? And then there's a team that actually signs off and makes sure that you are legit doing a correct experiment, not only for that experiment, so that we capture all the data, so that in the future, all of those experiments are actually put together and anyone can go look at them and say like, hey, did we try this already? What happened with this thing here? So it's very rigorous. I'm learning a lot about it. I'm no expert at all, but it's something that's a huge value differentiator for us.
That's fascinating. So is the team that, sort of goes over basically they give the grant, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm trying to map it onto like academia kind of thing. Is that team separate from the concerns of the company?
It's separate in that it's in a CFO's arm, but that's more organizational related, but they are separate they're engineers definitely, but they are, I think what you're saying is they're kind of
segregation of concerns is kind of
firewalled. Exactly. Yeah, the way that I think about it, I don't think they describe it this way. Is they're neutral, mm-hmm. right? You know, their job is to be neutral because I'm coming from the growth engineering team. And of course, there's bias. And I'm like, hey, I'm going to try this thing. I'm going to see if I can lift, you know, daily repins by blah. And of course, you want it to go up because, you know, your measurement is to, get that number up. Yeah. So their job is to be neutral, academic, and rigorous.
So what's your gig?
My gig is head of engineering. So I've got about 8 direct reports and about 290 other engineers that I'm responsible for.
And what's your day to day like?
I'm in about 80% meetings day to day, 70 to 80%. That's half hour, usually half hour to hour long meeting. Yep. Yeah. It sucks.
I'm laughing because that sucks. And B, we got you on a Sunday at 9 a.m. So.
This is the only time I had a van. Weekends are awesome because I can just sit there and like play Destiny. But Yeah, it's about majority meetings, and it's a lot of meetings. And I can kind of my superpowers is really around the care and feeding of the humans. So I'm doing a lot of gathering of information of the team, what's going on, whatever the latest fire is, and triangulating and figuring out, okay, what do we need to fix here? So it's probably if you believe leadership is people, process, and product, I'm people 60% of the time, process, is an even split between process and product, which makes me sad, but I do what I'm good at.
Why do you say sad? You'd rather focus on product or what?
I think all engineers want to go and build things. That's like what makes us happy. And I'm building things. It's just, it's around the people side and how do you get a team of 300 engineers moving quickly in an inspired way. So it turns out the product is the people.
Right.
It just has less of it's more abstract. I can't be like, oh, I checked in that code and hey, guy did a code review for me and I'm done with this thing. It's all like super fuzzy, pushing the iceberg sort of stuff.
Yeah, not that the people are the product in a Soylent Green kind of way, but
no.
Like people times process
exactly
equals product effectively.
That's good.
Right?
That's good. Yeah. I'm gonna write that down.
Go for it. You can tweet that.
No, let's do it in real time. No, I don't think.
So what we skipped is that.
Calendar. That's what I did there.
You have written quite a lot.
Oh yeah, that too.
About managing humans.
Yeah. So I've written two books. There's a second edition, soon to be a third edition of Managing Humans, which is sort of the book. That's a sort of it's a conglomeration of the blog into
Vance and Repose, by the way.
Vance and Repose, yes. Yeah. It's great. You always wanted, my goal for writing a book was to have someone say, hey, we should do a second edition because it means like you've done something that matters. So we're doing a second and doing a third edition of that. And then I wrote another one for O'Reilly. The first book was for A-Press called Being Geek, which I think will go through another edition. I'm still trying to figure out what to do there. But those two books are out there. And then I write the blog, which has, since I got to Pinterest, has not a ton of stuff. But it's still something I work on, believe it or not, every day.
It's definitely worth reading for any listeners.
Thank you.
A lot of insights. Both books are good too. I don't know how to say this without sounding like I'm making fun of you or making cracking a joke.
I'm being disassembled.
being disassembled. When it's Being Geek or Managing Humans, what is in the second edition? Because
right,
what's changed, right? Like what's the...
Yeah, so the second edition got rid of some chapters that were horrible. I was in the first edition. I was kind of scrambling to get those last 3 to 5 chapters. And I put in a couple of chapters that were bad and also didn't relevant. There was one about remote that was A, poorly written and B, misinformed. So I just got nuked that. The other thing that I've been doing, I'm going to be doing in this third edition is sort of a diversity pass. I don't know what you guys, I don't know what you guys are and gals are on gender pronouns, but like it's something obviously that's a hot topic right now. So I want to just kind of go through and pass on, getting that right and putting down sort of how do I feel about it. I just swap between he and she and because they is dumb. So I do that and allow and also put in like a statement about, hey, this is why I'm doing it this way. There's other things. I've been talking with some folks, especially like Grace Hopper. There's other words that just I think we're so deeply wired to be who we are. There's just some words in there that kind of stand out and they don't necessarily help the cause, if you will. I'll give you an example, which is like bitchin. And I say bitchin, I mean like, hey, I'm a surfer and it's bitchin, but that's not actually what I mean. There's actually something else there. So there's that sort of thing. I don't want to like lose myself to political correctness, but I have a view on this, which is much more informed than it was even a couple of years ago. And I just want to support those principles and those views. So those sorts of things. Plus I'm adding about 10 chapters from the last, I've added new chapters that are more relevant and just kind of flushing out the book.
That's great. I love that notion that you, with greater experience can go back and sort of,
it's awesome.
Refine the ideas that are there and put them in a broader context.
And it's also, if you write, which I think you both do, as you edit, you know, it's never done. And every time you get a chance to edit it, it gets better. So there's some chapters in there that have been on through me, an editor, and now me again. They're far superior than what was originally in the blog. So I love that because it just feels, it's kind of like code. You're like, oh, it's like 12% more efficient. Nailed it.
Yeah.
So,
and I know you agonize about your blog posts. Is that fair to say?
I have an editor and I still agonize about it. Yeah. I just like, I'm like impaired about spelling and grammar. I'm like legit impaired, like bad. So I would love to be able just to write something and have it be done, but I'm awful at it. So I've gotten better, but I still have an editor. And whenever someone says, hey, by the way, it's apostrophe. I'm like, ah, oh, motherfucker. Cause I don't see it. I mean, don't see it. It's just really hard. So I do agonize about it cause I really want it to be a considered thing.
Well, that's the problem. Like a human brain is very good at pattern recognition and language is very precise and the brain doesn't care. It's humans who get pedantic about that kind of stuff. And when you look over the course of history, how much language changes, it's sort of like getting upset that one spot in the river isn't identical every time.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. And I understand it. But to me, and this is why I got an editor. My editor is this woman up in Canada named Melanie. And she mailed me early on when I'd gotten a modicum of nerd fame. And she's like, and I was like, of course, you know, not editing at all, just posting it. And it was just awful. And she's like, your writing is really good. Your spelling grammar are just horrifically bad. And your voice is hurting because of that. And you go actually see when I started doing editing of the book and traffic, it went up and it could have just been momentum. But the more that I got sort of panicky about the editing process, I think the better the work, and I think the more that it resonated.
Well, it also takes, if people notice it, it pulls them out of the writing. So the more that they don't notice, the less ethereal voice there is, and they can just understand the ideas.
Agreed. That's a good line. I've got to write that down too.
Just steal all the stuff. So speaking of considered choices, you've been responsible of your career for a lot of hiring and management. And
I have.
Of humans.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sort of a guiding principle to that?
In terms of how I hire folks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the high order bits, like this is good or not. What you're looking
for? It's changed a lot and it changes a lot in terms of what I'm looking for. It changes depending on what the company needs. So it's my current rubric, if you will, is I'm looking for three things. And this is, if you asked me a year ago, the answer would have been totally different. But right now there's three things that I'm looking at and I'm trying to vet in the half hour, the hour that I have. And I'm usually talking with leadership folks. So so the individual contributor rubric is a little bit different, but actually not that much. There's three buckets. There's the vision piece, which is, can they see where they want to go? Can they see where they want to go? And is it a compelling place? Or is it like, if I stumbled, fell forward, hit my head on the ground, it'd be an obvious choice? Or is it like, this is a year out? Can they do that? And whether that's an IC or a leader, I'm looking for both. I'm looking for the
contributor.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry.
No, that's cool.
That is tied with the second piece, which is great. Do they have execution? Can they actually demonstrate to me that they have the ability to get to that point in the future? Which is, we can talk about that in a second. And the third piece is really values. And this one is a little bit tricky, but it might be the most important one, which is there's always a culture of people and they have a set of values and they have a culture or whatever the hell they call it. But in, you know, it's not a touchy-feely thing. It's actually a legit differentiator. Mm-hmm. And a company that or a team that does that really well, that has, I guess, strong value alignment, what I see and what I like to see is they have better judgment because they can say, hey, we value this when let's pick one at Pinterest, which is go, like go fast. We value go. So therefore, this decision that I'm making is based on this principle. And it kind of aligns things. It gets things kind of headed. This is all assuming that your values are like not corrupt or like well-defined or are well-defined. Sure. But it's that piece as well, which is, do they demonstrate sound judgment? And that is usually both just sort of innate, who are you as a human, but also who are you relative to the values of this organism that you're in. That's the other piece I always look for. Because when I see bad judgment, you can't explain why you made that decision or how you got there. That's usually a yellow to red flag to me. Like, are you just fucking making it up? Or, you know, so those are the three that I'm sort of looking at. And I'm actually writing about this right now to try to, how do you ask questions to find those things out? Because pretty tricky stuff, right? And how do you get that out in like 1 hour?
Well, one thing that I'm glad you brought up is the sort of the decision making inside a set of given goals thing,
right?
Because hiring for culture can too often seem that you're fighting diversity, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So how do you?
Well,
given that you're aiming you're not, because culture or they're a good fit is different than these are the goals that we operate under and assist candidate.
So can I tell you a quick story? Because what I did about 3 to 6 months ago was Pinterest was coming out with this sort of broad goals around diversity. And I had to explain it to the engineering team. And let's just start by saying from a social justice perspective, it's just the right thing to do. Full stop. Can't argue with that. Anyone who wants to argue with that, I'm going to tear you apart. Yeah. So we get that, right? And it's worth having a discussion about that part. But for engineers, it's more about okay, show me the numbers. So I did a lot of research with the team to kind of why is this as a shareholder, why do I care about this? And there's just all sorts of research there about how a more diverse workforce gives you better decision making, the company's more valuable, blah, blah, blah. But that's still not very concrete. There was this one thing that really resonated with me, and Guy, it leads to the question you're asking me right now, which is around groupthink. There's this test that they did, I forget when, it was called the Ash Conformity Test, and it had 8 folks in it, and one of them was a person who was there for the actual test. The other 7 folks were actors. So their responses were scripted. And what they had to do was they got this graph and had 3 lines on it, A, B, and C, and they were all different sizes, or it looked like they all looked like they were all different sizes. And then it's 8 people, all they had to do was look at one line and say, which line is the same size as the graph, A, B, and C. So, okay, it looks like it's A. And they just voted in whatever random way. And more often than, unless it was something wrong with the line, it was very obvious which line it was. Everyone followed, picked the right pairing, it's C. But then what they did is they had all 7 vote before the 8. And they all voted wrong. So they picked the one that was obviously wrong. And this is the thing that got me, which was right? So this 8th person, whoever he or she was looking at, and you could see the vote. It was an open vote. It would be it's not C, it's B, right? 75% of the participants, those number 8s, would have made a wrong choice. So what is that? What's going on there? That's groupthink, right? That's I don't want to diverge. Have you been in that meeting? I've been in that meeting. It's blue, right? And you're like, it's not fucking blue. It's red. You guys are crazy. Oh, but it's blue. Yeah, totally. Whatever you said.
Yeah.
But that's the risk that you have with a not diverse workforce is you start to see these sorts of groupthink things. And there's other reasons to do that. That's the reason you want to have just people with different opinions in the room is you want to see all angles. You want to see all angles on the problem. And you get, again, you get better debate. By the way, it's more painful. It's not fun because people aren't agreeing with you, which you don't want. You don't want that agreement thing. So that's one of the reasons I'm big on this right now is I know the teams are going to be healthy. You're going to learn more about the world. You're going to build better product. You're going to make better decisions. Sorry, that was a long answer. But
it's perfect. That's why you're here. I do think that I don't want to use the term conflict, but considered argument, respectful argument.
Right.
There's a huge amount of value in that.
Yeah,
if you can argue with somebody, then walk away and still be friends. That's awesome. All you've done is expose more ideas.
and be still be friends, right? But be willing to like have that sort of, you know, at Pinterest, we have these things on the walls that say the hard thing. And it's like, this is what I'm feeling about this. I'm going to say it. And it's meant to be, you know, I had this great coach at Palantir who told me, he's like, feedback is a gift. And it is, right? It's sometimes when you hear it, you're like, okay, yeah, wow, I'm feeling like a horrible person for doing that thing. But it's really an opportunity for the world to kind of show you, you know, a different perspective, or like something that has something that you're doing that perhaps is not doing what you intended it to do. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
Take a quick break so I can tell you about something awesome, and that is Casper. Casper makes premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, and that's because Casper cuts out dealers, they cut out resellers, they cut out showrooms, and they pass that savings directly on to us. They're high quality, they provide resilience and long-lasting supportive comfort. They're one of a kind, they're a new hybrid. They combine premium latex foam with memory foam. And you know, mattresses can often sell for over $1,500, but Casper mattresses cost between $500 for twin, $600 for twin XL, $750 for full size, $850 for queen, $950 for king. They understand that, you know, ordering a mattress online, it's not the normal way we've learned to do it. So they go out of their way to make it risk-free and make it super convenient. They do free delivery and returns within 100 days. Statistically speaking, lying in a mattress for 4 minutes is no indicator of how a mattress is actually going to perform. You want it in your home, in your room. You want it to be your bed. You want to sleep on it the way you always sleep. That'll give you a true indication of how well it works, and that's what Casper provides. They understand the importance of truly trying out a mattress in reality, because it's something that you spend a third of your life on. They're also obsessively engineered, despite their shockingly fair price. They have just the right sink, just the right bounce. Again, two technologies, latex foam and memory foam. They come together for brighter days and better nights. They have a risk-free trial return policy, 100 days, free delivery, painless returns. They're made in America. Again, they start for $500 for twin size, $950 for king size. And you compare that to industry averages, they are outstandingly well priced. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to casper.com/debug and use promo code debug, and you can get $50 towards the purchase of any mattress. Again, casper.com/debug, promo code debug. I've been using one for over a year now, and they are fantastic. It leads to a very healthy, a very healing, a very good, a very deep night's sleep. So really check them out. Casper, they do a fantastic job. casper.com/debug, promo code debug. Thanks, Casper.
Do you have it? So what's your advice for people that are looking for a gig? Not just at Pinterest, but anywhere. Just and in the broadest sense.
What am I, my advice? My advice is
you looking for a certain set of things, and I think we've established what they are. How does somebody best express those to you without being like, "Hi Lop, I heard your interview on Debug, and here are the three things that I find the most important."
I will tell you my question that it's totally unfair, but this is the question, and it always gets a giggle out of people. But I ask this whether you're 60 or whether you're 10. I say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And everyone kind of goes and says, ha ha, kind of, it's kind of soft opener, but it shows me I'm very interested in the answer, and there's no right or wrong answer to that. Right. But the people that are like, well, I want to do this for 2 years and I'm fucking moving to the Amazon because I want to learn how to do something crazy in the Amazon. There's that to me, check vision, right? You know, it's
yeah,
right. It's a little bit nuts. Who knows whether they, you know, the execution or the values piece. But that's one thing that I'm usually looking for, is that, you know, you're living deliberately, if you will. And that's the thing that I'm looking for when I'm talking with folks, is that it's not enthusiasm. It's not like, woohoo, yeah, I'm going to the Amazon. It's more like, yeah, I kind of have a plan, and this thing here could be an awesome part of it, but I'm headed in a direction. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the first
thing. Well, that's interesting because, I mean, the stereotypical one is, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And the expected answer is, I don't even know. I mean, like doing the job that at a higher level, like, you know, supplicating myself to the company. It's like, is that the right answer?
There's probably places that is the right answer, and we don't want to work there.
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah.
No,
but that's interesting that you also don't want to necessarily hire people to say that.
I mean, I'd love for people to stay there. I really, sure. It's my job to create an environment that people want to – to be there as long as possible. But let's just be super realistic that humans, you know, your average is like you're, especially in the Silicon Valley or in tech, is sort of like about 3 years or so. And that's not mercenary. There's definitely mercenaries in there that I want to get their, you know, 3 years vesting and move on to the next one. I'm not particularly interested in working with those folks. I'm very interested in working with folks who are in it to win it, who are there to like do the best possible work, are like deeply committed and have strong execution or really bad execution, but are open to program and project managers who help with execution.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what I'm looking for.
Just from the way you're dropping sort of job positions like program project managers, ICs, Pinterest is kind of set up this similarly to Apple, I take it?
No, it's not. The role at Pinterest that doesn't exist necessarily at Apple is product manager. Hmm. Product managers at Apple, and maybe this has changed, I haven't been there in a while, is sort of an amalgam of engineering manager and sort of design manager. So those are the folks responsible for the product. What Apple has, and I have actually recently done this at Pinterest, is this role office called a program management, engineering program management, EPM. You've probably heard that before. Yeah. So EPM is sort of for pure technical engineering side of the world product. Like let's pick something like there's an EPM for Mac OS 10. I have an EPM for performance because it's not one part of the product. It's the whole damn stack. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit different in that we have a stronger product management voice at Pinterest than at Apple, which is, that's just it's a different setup.
That's interesting. Is it the fact that it's a website? Does that change stuff up a bit? Because I know this is probably a very facile way of thinking about this, but you've got one product, right? It's the website.
Well,
and
it
that's
is.
Not entirely true. Because
it's not, yeah. So I've got the website. I have the Android application. I have the iOS application. I have the set of services which deliver that. I have the to me there's many products there. I understand what you're saying. There's one product that is Pinterest, but there's many different
vectors,
deliverables, if you will.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that tough to coordinate?
It is very tough, which is why we have the emerging EPM right. roles,
yeah.
keeping all of those trains on time when we've got all of those. And also you've got external dependencies like Apple's review cycle or Google's and these sorts of things. So we release, I think, twice a day on the web. iOS is like once a month or so. I think Android is similar. So a lot of coordination, and it's something, you know, 70% of Pinterest engineering has been hired since I got there. Getting that all coordinated and still keeping your values and keeping all of that sort of right. together is a challenge. But this is basically what I similar to the gig at Palantir. We did from 200 to like 1400 or so. Oh. So it's that rapid growth phase, which is, it's my sweet spot. Come in at 200.
So if somebody, if a company hires Loft, just
probably growing.
Just for the sake of the listeners, could you guys describe a little bit about what an EPM is? Because it's not in a lot of companies.
Yeah, engineering program managers. There's program managers. Sorry, there's three types of P's, if you will. There's program, there's product, and there's project. Program to me, and this is mostly what the EPM role is a coordination amongst multiple teams to achieve a common goal. So we need to ship Mac OS 10. You need multiple, but probably a whole team of program managers to make sure all of those different parts are coming together and going to get out the door. Product managers are more on the strategic vision of the product piece. Like, we want to do this feature. What is it going to achieve? What does winning look like? And then there's finally project manager. This is my definition, but project managers are the ones, think of it as a single project that needs to be done. Like, hey, we've got this, we want to move to Jira. This project needs to have someone coordinating, making sure that we're dotting all our I's and crossing all our T's. So project is sort of a smaller version. Many projects equal a program, if you want to think about it like that. And also many products equal, I'd say, a program as well.
And most of these, I don't want to say that, I don't know how to express this without, because it's going to sound sucky, but these people spend a lot of time in Jira or Radar or going through bug reports and assigning different things. That's a better way of see. This is why you're the big shot.
You can refer people back to the
people and like, well, it's managing tickets and like making sure people are doing what they're supposed to be doing, right?
We can refer people back to the Ryan Nielsen episode where he talks about doing that for OS 10.
Yeah, because I think it is. It's a rewarding and fascinating job. It just sounds shitty when you say that. It's like, you go through a bunch of bug reports, but
there are humans that are really, really. I know exactly what you're saying because it bores the hell out of me too, and I totally respect the work, but it bores the hell out of me as well.
I'm detail-oriented in programming way, and like I'm a huge nerd about super specific stuff. But when it gets that broad, I can't fit in my head, kind of thing.
But there are humans that are great at this. There are humans that love this and that it just floats their boat because they want to organize all the things. And that I support that 100%.
Oh, yeah. You gotta have that. Seriously, like, man, those and good testers.
Yeah.
If you don't have those two, you forget
it. Yeah, no. They just like, it's like the superpower, superhuman breaking things power. It's like, what? How?
That's invaluable. That is seriously invaluable. Love that. So I suppose one of the big questions is, what do you do to keep these people around?
Yeah, different things float people's boats in different ways.
Of course,
But the thing that I've noticed is that you've got to keep a big, huge challenge they care about squarely in front of them, and you've got to be aggressively making sure that's the right thing. And the moment that it's not the right thing, you switch it around in a way that is perhaps not short-term great for the team or the project they're on, but long-term great from their retention perspective, their happiness perspective. I'll give you an example, and this has been a challenge. I just had a lot of meetings about this last week. We have what's called an open transfer policy at Pinterest, which is a very employee-friendly version of an internal transfer, which is once they want to go somewhere, they are very much encouraged to do so, and their manager has no or little say in terms of them moving. And it's not that managers are bad, but managers are very optimized on what are the things, what are my goals for the next quarter? And they will forever optimize towards shipping those things and not necessarily optimize around like, oh, Mary really is, she's been here 2 years and she's been here a while, but I just need her to hear like 3 more months. And because they'll do that and then they'll do that again in like 3 more months. So we actually say, listen, after 6 months, you are welcome to move around within the company. And the idea is to, who knows better about when someone's getting bored, but the person. So it allows them to quickly address something and move around. There's some risk to that, which is you get more sort of transfer thrash. And we're still figuring that out at Pinterest right now. But that is a great way to kind of like keep people engaged, because the situation you want to avoid, and this is gone through this many times, is not like someone quits. Someone quits is there, it's like it's already done, right? They've already given up. Mm-hmm. What you're looking for is that moment of shields down 6 months earlier where they were like, I'm kind of interested in doing something else. And what's going on here? Oh, my friend at LinkedIn mailed me. Oh, hey, John, what's going on? And suddenly what was just a small little thing, their shields are down, they get infected, and suddenly they're like, gosh, I really am unhappy here. And there's nothing in front of me I'm working on. And LinkedIn looks like, you know, it looks like a great place to go. So, and suddenly what was an avoidable, easy moment to fix 6 months ago is suddenly you trying to perform this diving save, which usually doesn't work, by the way, to kind of keep this person here. And so the question is, how do you get as far upstream about keeping someone engaged? And these are things I lose sleep over most nights.
I like that you're using LinkedIn as the place that they would go to rather than the vector the vector through which, like,
there's a lot of good people at LinkedIn. LinkedIn is – I didn't know how big they were. I mean, you can go look at their stock price. They're doing really well. Yeah, no, they're doing really well.
Yeah. They're like a quiet giant in a
number. Yeah, right.
Which – I don't know if you guys are so quiet anymore, but Pinterest is bigger than I think people think it is.
Yeah. When I tell people how big engineering is, they're like, what are all those engineering doing? It's just pins, right? And then I get rage and I'm like, okay. And they tear them apart. And I was like, well, let me tell you what's going on here, people. The company is 600 plus, I believe.
Wow. So when these people move, you say that, so I suppose when they join the company, they've 6 months in the position that they were hired into.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is it 6 months for every subsequent move, or is there any limit on that?
No, it's, you know, it's, we're talking about this right now because we just went through planning for Q4 this current quarter, and there was a lot of people moving around, and there was a lot of plans that were like, hey, we said we're going to do X. We couldn't because Bob moved. And it's
because I imagine all the EPMs are pulling their hair out at that point.
No, exactly. It's the, in this case, it's the product managers. EPMs are anyway, we have both.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's they are pulling their hair out. They're like, hey, we got 2 weeks. So, of course, we didn't get done what we said we were going to do. So, to me, it's not really the timing that's the issue for us. It's more just sort of the agreement with the person who's leaving and their project about, you know, principled again. It's like, do you finish what you say you're going to finish?
Right.
So it's more about what is the sort of the interim time frame that we're dealing with. But yeah, it's we're a little thrashy right now.
How does that reflect on the people whose teams get thrashed out of?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, well, we promised you this. We can't do it because some other interesting product spun up.
Sure.
And our best people left. Like two of our best people just took off out of our team of four, you know?
Right. It tends to not happen that. It's more onesie twosie sort of thing. But it is what you're describing, the situation you're describing is occurring. Is how do you plan when you may not have those people the entire quarter. That's one of the things we're talking about right now is maybe if we're going to be on a quarterly planning process, which is a lot of things we are right now, maybe just to do it around the quarterly timeframe, which allows, you know, you can still move. It's just like, finish the quarter, please. Right.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah, exactly.
3 months is you're not asking too much from anybody at that
and
point.
It's always going to be less than that, right? It's
not right.
The max being 3 months, it should be the exception, not the norm.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems pretty reasonable. Okay, so you're in a pretty competitive industry.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. do you see sort of the hiring practices and the management and the retention policies as one of the key sort of components of the competition vector?
Yeah. No, that's why I'm at 60% is because of exactly that. It's finding the right team, making sure you've got the right team together it's the gig, right? The right set of folks, right set of, you know, diverse set of opinions, all of that. Getting those folks there that's phase one. And then phase two, as you just said, is sort of like, how do you retain? How do you make sure that those folks are there, happy, productive for a good long time? So that's most of my job right now is doing just that in engineering.
So you've been there, what, a year and a bit now?
1 year and about 3 months, I think. Yeah.
And most of the employees, I believe, have come in, what, the past year sort of thing?
70% of engineering has been in the last, since I got there. So we've more than doubled since I've been there.
Have you managed to maintain, and I'm going to use the word culture, but by culture, I mean what you were using before, like the sort of the core principles. Have you managed to maintain that or?
Yeah, and I'd like to say that was my fault, but it wasn't. I think I helped, but Ben and Evan, the co-founders of Pinterest, I think a couple of years before, really sat down and figured out what are the values that we care about, and they did. They were very introspective. They worked with the entire company on it, I believe. And the reason I know that isn't because I was there, is because there's just no like hour that passes at Pinterest when someone's not throwing down. It's like we knit here. Knitting is what we call it because, you know, it's kind of a crafty sort of, you know, vibe, but it's also collaboration. We knit here. So that's something, and it's going to be in your face like at least 3 times a day. Go, you know, all of these values are there and they're just, they're on the walls, but they're part of the DNA. So, we did a similar exercise about 6 months with engineering to kind of figure out what are the core values for engineering. And we did the same thing. They're in support of the company values, but a little bit more, a little more engineering. Like we build Legos, we build things that anyone can use to get product out the door, get technology out the door. So we've been working on that, but we're really working within the framework that was set before I got there. And whenever I get asked like by startups about like, what do I need to do? I'm like, work on your values. And they're like, well, we're not even a sure thing. And I'm like, if you don't have values, you don't have that last bullet, which is that piece of that gives people judgment and allows you to move fast in a way that is sort of compliant isn't the right word, but you know what I mean? That's kind of within the framework of the judgment framework of the company. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So
well, they set the direction, right? It's almost a shame that they're called values because it seems wishy-washy or
– Yeah, well, did you ever culture, have those, that's another wishy-washy term.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not really. It's sort of guiding principles.
Yeah, yeah.
Prime directors or prime yeah. Like there's something to it that.
Yeah. No, it's. I mean, it's my life.
Because it's not asking people to disregard their own personal values, but it's more like, look, in the company, these are the things you need to consider. Exactly. Yeah.
No, it's totally. I agree. The fuzziness there, and if there's a huge amount of subjectivity, which especially with engineers makes it really fuzzy. But if you do that well, they are they're a handful of North Stars, if you will. And that to me is super useful to keeping the right direction, velocity, whatever the hell it is that you're trying to work on within the team or the company.
Yeah. No, I agree. And of course it's going to have a fuzzy, it's a fuzzy thing inherently.
Yep.
I don't know. I wish there was a word that didn't sound fuzzy because it's not, I don't know. It's like gravity wells or something like like the way that you're going to fall through this decision-making process.
I totally like, I live and breathe the ambiguity that you're describing, but isn't it that very ambiguity that kind of makes it awesome?
Yes.
It's right. And it's like that subjectivity and how I apply my experience, blah, 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 whatever, to understanding it and making judgments against it. That's actually kind of cool. It's hard. It's not black and white, obviously, but it's still, that's kind of cool to me that if you do those values well, I was talking with the former CTO of Amazon and I was talking to him about retaining senior engineers and what to do about that. And he gave me, I think, the nicest compliment that I've ever received in my life. And I was like, I was paused after he said it. This guy is a guy, it's Rick Dalzell. He did a bunch of stuff at Amazon early on. And he was like, Lop, what I like about what you're saying, God, it's a compliment to myself. This is totally self-serving. It was a great compliment. He's like, Lop, what I like what you're doing is every time you're trying to work through something, you go back to your core principles and you say, this is why I'm deciding this. He's like, you're going to go really far with having a principle-based approach to how you're actually making decisions and getting things done. And I don't know why. It's not like a super like poetic compliment, but it was like, I'm like, aw, because that's really how I think is like, I'm sitting here trying, because my job is ambiguous. I've got people stuff and there's always an argument in each direction. They're both sounds valid. If I found the right set of principles to work against, it's, again, it's kind of code, by the way, kind of like programming. It's like, if I have that thing, it gives me a structure. And by the way, it makes things that are really, when whoever's on the losing side of that decision, it makes it a little bit easier, even though they lost, to say like, oh, okay, well, it's at least a principle. I understand the principle and I understand what we're doing here.
It's not personal.
It's not personal. This sucks. I hate it. But, you know, I understand what the principle is that he or she is using to make that decision.
I guess coming back around to sort of what we started talking about, which would be diversity. And try to stick to.
I think that's what it is. I think that's number one. I think the other thing is like know what you're great at and know what you're bad at. I think that's really that ability to be self-reflective and to, because I've a lot of times, this is hard. Like I said it earlier when I kind of broke down the people, product, and process piece. I would love to be doing more product, but the actual place you probably should invest your LOP dollars is on the people and the culture. And that's great. The thing about being reasonably good at a thing is it's sort of boring because you're good at it, right? So of course you go to the things that you're not as good at, which maybe I would love to do product. Maybe I'm great at it, but I keep on ending up on the people and the process side. But it's like you're going to get differentiated value from me on the people side and on the getting, how do we build a team, a company, a technology stack? That's where you want me. And I think there's a lot of humans and managers out there right now that are probably, if they're not aware of what they're bad at, they should figure that out as soon as possible. And if they want to know, if you don't know, go ask someone that you know, that you love, and say like, hey, what am I bad at? And I'm like, you're bad at this. And you're like, what? Like, no, you really are. Right. It's because it's usually a revelation to a lot of people that where do they have those gaps? And you can go work on that gap. Like, God bless you, go for it. But chances are, relative to your superpower, those gaps, you're never going to get better than a B, is my guess, right? And that's great. If you want to go do that and that's what you like, awesome. But for leading of people, like, it should be all just, you should be world-class in what you're doing and be an exemplar of what is great. And that's, I think that's something I think I'd ask managers to do is like, trust, understand what you're bad at. And like, for me, the reason I'm building the EPM structure at Pinterest is I got the vision piece. Like, I got the 5-year plan. This is where we're going. Here's the facts. The execution piece, as we talked about, I'm not that great at. I'm okay at it. I can make it a B, but like, you don't really want me to do that. So I'm building an EPM organization because engineering execution has to be an A. So, and that's because I got a gap there, and that's something I'm going to build into. That was a long answer.
No, that's good. I think complementary to that, or maybe even a flip side, is that any new job that I've taken that I've really enjoyed and excelled at, I have has sort of covered things that I don't know if I'm good at yet. No, no. But do you know what I mean? Like, I've never been ready for the job that I walk into.
Yeah, totally.
Which I don't think disputes your A quality, B quality thing, but I mean, I think that having room to grow, and to try to discover these things is valuable. Even if you find out that, you know what, I'm not actually good at that. You probably found out that you were not great at what you're calling a B,
solid B,
at execution, because you had to do it a lot, and so you've now found your like where you best have value, right? But that came through.
It came through doing it, absolutely.
Yeah, you can't just like meditate on it and give yourself a scorecard. You got to see what actually happens. So,
yeah, no, that's it. It's know thyself, I think, is the line.
Know thyself. Well, now you know thy lop.
Know yourself, know your opponent, 100 battles, 100 victories.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool, Michael. That was awesome.
Awesome. Great.
Thanks, man.
If people want to find you on this wacky internet place, where can they go?
You can go to Twitter, Rans. I sound like a fortune cookie. And also Rans in Repose. That's one word. RansinRepose.com is the blog. And
your Instagram feed is amazing.
Oh yeah. I'm on Instagram. It's Rans again. And if you really want to follow someone amazing, you should follow my wife. It's R Lop, Rochelle Lop. She's amazing as well. We compete on Instagram. True story. Whenever there's a great sunset here, you say insta-dibs in the Lop family, it means you get first rights to the thing. It doesn't, nice. She never respects it, but at least we say it like insta-dibs. So, yeah. So there's a little competition going on there.
And people should check out Pinterest if they haven't already. It's a good company.
Pinterest is absolutely amazing. There's 60 billion pins there, and I guarantee you there's something there that will inspire you.
Wow. That's cool. You guys hiring?
We are hiring all the people.
Okay. So go check that out if you're looking for a job.
That'd be awesome.
Cool. Thanks, man. That was a lot of fun.
Awesome.